clear the notice had been mailed on April 1st, but it had been sent by surface mail. I called home to make sure the draft board knew I hadn't been a draft resister for 9 days and asked what I should do. They told me the surface mailing was their mistake, and besides, under the rules, I got to finish the term I was in. So I was instructed to come home for induction when I finished. When I got home at the end of June, I had about a month before reporting for induction, during which I was free to make other military arrangements. There were no available spots in the National Guard or Reserves. I looked into the Air Force, but I learned I couldn't become a jet pilot because I didn't have fusion vision. I had a weak left eye, which had often tilted outward when I was very young. It had largely corrected itself, but my vision still didn't come to a single point, and apparently the consequences in flight could be severe. I also took a physical for a naval officer program, but failed it too, this time because of poor hearing, a problem I hadn't noticed and wouldn't until a decade later, when I entered politics and often couldn't hear or understand people talking to me in crowds. The best option left seemed to be enrolling in law school and joining the Army Reserve Officer Training Corps at the University of Arkansas. On July 17th, I went to Fayetteville, and in 2 hours was accepted by both. The officer in charge of the program, Colonel Eugene Holmes, told me he was taking me because I would be of greater service to the country as an officer than as a draftee. His second-in-command, Lieutenant Colonel Clint Jones, seemed more conservative and skeptical of me, but we had a pleasant talk about his daughter, whom I had known and liked in Washington. Joining ROTC meant that I would go on active duty after law school. Apparently, they couldn't formally enroll me until the next summer, because I had to go to summer camp before I could enter ROTC classes. But signing a letter of intent was enough for the draft board to waive my induction date and give me a 1D reservist classification. As the summer wore on, I felt worse and worse about my decision to join the ROTC and go to Arkansas Law School. I had a hard time sleeping and spent most nights in the den in the white reclining chair in which I'd watched Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech 6 years earlier. I'd read until I could nod off for a few hours. Because I had joined the ROTC late, I couldn't go to the required summer camp until the following summer. So Colonel Holmes agreed to let me go back to Oxford for a second year, which meant that I wouldn't begin my post-law school military service for 4 years rather than three. I was still disturbed by my decision. A conversation with a visitor from Oklahoma made me more uncertain. Warren Miles quit school at 18 to join the Marines and go to Korea, where he was wounded in action. He came home and went to Hendricks College, where he won a Rhodes Scholarship. He encouraged me to bag the safety of my present course, join the Marines, and go to Vietnam, where at least I'd really learn something. He dismissed my opposition to the war out of hand, saying there was not a thing I could do about the fact of the war, and as long as it was there, decent people ought to go, experience, learn, remember. It was a hell of an argument. But I already remembered. I remembered what I'd learned working on the Foreign Relations Committee, including the classified evidence that the American people were being misled about the war. I was really torn. As the son of a World War II veteran, I grew up on John Wayne movies and had always admired people who served in the military. Now I searched my heart, trying to determine whether my aversion to going was rooted in conviction or cowardice. Given the way it played out, I'm not sure I ever answered that question for myself. The day I flew back to Oxford, our local paper carried the front-page news that my classmate, Army Lieutenant Mike Thomas, who had defeated me for student council president in junior high school, had been killed in Vietnam. Mike's unit came under attack and took cover. He died when he went back into the line of fire to rescue one of his men who was trapped in their vehicle. A mortar shell killed them both. After his death, the Army gave him a Silver Star, a Bronze Star, and a Purple Heart. Now, almost 39,000 Americans had perished in Vietnam, with 19,000 casualties still to come. Sometime in the next few days, I called Jeff Dwyer from England, told him I wanted to be put back in the draft, and asked him to tell Bill Armstrong. On October 30th, the draft board reclassified me 1A. On October 1st, President Nixon had ordered a change in Selective Service System policy to allow graduate students to finish the entire school year they were in, not just the term, so I wouldn't be called until July. I do remember feeling both relieved that I'd get to spend some more time at Oxford and that the draft situation was resolved. I was reconciled to the fact that I'd probably be called up at the end of the Oxford year. I also asked Jeff to talk to Colonel Holmes. I still felt an obligation to him. He had helped me to avoid being inducted on July the 28th. Even though I was now 1A again, if he held me to my commitment to the ROTC program beginning with next summer's camp, I thought I would have to do it. Jeff indicated that the colonel accepted my decision, but thought I was making a mistake. On December 1st, pursuant to a bill signed by President Nixon 5 days earlier, the United States instituted a draft lottery, with a drawing in which all the days of the year were pulled out of a bowl. The order in which your birthday came up determined the order in which you could be drafted. August 19th came up 311. Even with the high lottery number, for months afterward, I thought I had a fair chance of being drafted. On March the 21st, 1970, I got a letter from Lee Williams saying that he had talked to Colonel Lefty Hawkins, the head of the Arkansas Selective Service System, who told him we would all be called. When I got the high draft number, I called Jeff again and asked him to tell Colonel Holmes I hadn't gone back into the draft knowing this would happen, and that I understood that he could still call me on the ROTC obligation. Then, on December 3rd, I sat down and wrote Colonel Holmes. I thanked him for protecting me from the draft the previous summer, told him how much I admired him, and said I doubted that he would have admired me had he known more about my political beliefs and activities. I described my work for the Foreign Relations Committee, quote, a time when not many people had more information about Vietnam at hand than I did. I told him that after I left Arkansas the previous summer, I did some work for the Vietnam Moratorium in Washington and in England. I expressed sympathy with conscientious objectors and draft resistors. I told him Frank Aller, whom I identified only as my roommate, was one of the bravest, best men I know. His country needs men like him more than they know. That he is considered a criminal is an obscenity. Then I admitted that I had considered being a resistor myself and accepted the draft, quote, in spite of my beliefs for one reason, to maintain my political viability within the system. I confessed to the colonel that after I signed the ROTC letter of intent, I began to wonder whether the compromise I had made with myself was not more objectionable than the draft would have been. Because I had no interest in the ROTC program in itself, and all I seemed to have done was to protect myself from physical harm. After we had made our agreement and you sent my 1D deferment to my draft board, the anguish and loss of self-regard and self-confidence really set in. By the second week of March 1970, I knew I was free of the ROTC obligation, but not the draft. As it turned out, Lee Williams was wrong. The de-escalation of the war reduced the need for new troops, to the point that my number was never called. I always felt bad about escaping the risks that had taken the lives of so many of my generation, whose claim to a future was as legitimate as mine. Over the years, as governor when I was in charge of the Arkansas National Guard, and especially after I became president, the more I saw of America's military, the more I wished I'd been a part of it when I was young, though I never changed my feelings about Vietnam. When I returned to Oxford in early October for my surprise second year, the circumstances of my life were almost as complicated as they had been in Arkansas. I didn't have a place to stay because until the end of the summer I hadn't thought I was coming back, and we got guaranteed rooms in college only the first year. I lived with Rick Stearns for a couple of weeks, during which we worked on and participated in our own Vietnam moratorium observance at the U.S. Embassy in London on October 15th, in support of the main event back in the United States. I also helped organize a teach-in at the London School of Economics. Eventually, I found a home for the rest of my stay at Oxford with Strobe Talbot and Frank Aller at 46 Leckford Road. Someone else who had been slated to live with them left, and they needed me to share the rent. We paid about £36 a month, $86.40 at the exchange rate of $2.40 a pound. I sent in an application to Yale Law School, though I wasn't at all sure I'd be able to go, even if I got in. That same month, during our long winter break, I began a 40-day trip that would take me from Amsterdam through the Scandinavian countries to Russia, then back to Oxford through Prague and Munich. It was, and remains, the longest trip of my life. When I returned to England, I did so with renewed faith in America and democracy. For all its faults, my country was still a beacon of light to people chafing under communism in Eastern Europe and Russia. Ironically, when I ran for president in 1992, the Republicans tried to use the trip against me, claiming that I had consorted with communists in Moscow.